From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, a look at the fanatic personality with Amos Oz, one of Israel's most prominent novelists and peace activists. Also today, I speak with rock singer Rick Springfield. His hit Jesse's Girl and his role on the soap opera General Hospital made him a teen heartthrob. Now he's back with a new album. With warmer weather on the way, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of Mozart's Serenades, works the composer designed to be played on a summer's eve. And Mark Halliday reads a poem he wrote as an exorcism of bad memories. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Amos Oz is one of Israel's leading novelists and also one of its most prominent peace activists. In his roles as both activist and writer, he's tried to understand why Israel didn't become the exemplary state, the small-scale laboratory for democracy that old-time Jewish idealists dreamed of and planned for. Oz was a co-founder of the Peace Now movement in Israel, and he advocates reconciliation with the Arabs. In his new novel, Black Box, he explores the fanatic personality, the kind of extremism that divides Israel from within and makes compromise impossible. One character in Black Box, Alec, is an academic who has become an expert in analyzing the fanatic personality. His ex-wife is married to Michel, a man who is himself a religious right-wing extremist. I asked Amos Oz to describe these two characters.
Well, on the surface, they could not be more different, conflicting and contradicting each other. Alec is cool, intellectual, masterly, a very domineering tyrant of an intellectual character. Michel Somo is an Oriental Jew, a Sephardi, a religious one, a very warm person, totally insecure, and on the surface, a fanatical true believer. Beneath the surface, it's a little more complex. There is a lot of zealotry in liberal, permissive, progressive Alex, and a lot of tolerance in Michel Somo.
Do you see that as standing for a kind of generalization in the larger scheme of things?
I was afraid this was coming. You know, if Herman Melville would have written Moby Dick in South Africa, it would be immediately taken for a fable about whites and blacks. In Latin America, they would read Moby Dick as a fable about macho and revolution. Some countries are probably doomed to have their literatures immediately interpreted in a general way. Well, yes, in a sense, all said and done, there is an Israeli dimension to the novel, but it's first and foremost a novel about a private relationship between half a dozen people, a love-hate relationship.
One of the issues at the root of the novel is, what is fanaticism? Who is a fanatic? What forms that kind of fanatic spirit? What did you do as research in a way for the book to help answer that question yourself so that you could convincingly create the characters and the ambiguities within the characters?
Just looking around and listening very carefully to the way people talk. I've been born and brought up in a very temperamental country, which has been traditionally a loading stone for redeemers, fanatics, crucifiers, and crucified ones for generations. So I have become myself a bit of an authority on comparative fanaticism, I dare say. And it's not always in the places where you obviously look for it. It's not always in the observant or religious or nationalistic people. It can be anywhere. I'd say that fanaticism is a basic shortage, a basic lack of gift for life. And a fanatic is a person who is fascinated and preoccupied by death, obsessed by death. In this respect, Alex, the researcher of fanaticism, may have more fanaticism about himself than the true believer Michel Somo in that novel.
I know that you don't want to see your fiction as symbolic of the state of Israel, but you see your fiction as playing a role in the political dialogue of your country, since in much of your writing, you address issues of the country.
Yes, in a sense, everything that I've written so far is set in Israel, and in the broadest sense, it is political, though not political in a partisan way. You see, Israel is the only country in the world, I suppose, where a daily newspaper would run an editorial, unsigned editorial, picking an issue with a fictitious character in a fiction, which is fun in a sense. I think Israelis are immensely sensitive to their literature, and they are exposed to it perhaps more than any other nation under the sun. They are very passionate and emotional about the Israeli literature. And this very novel evoked a lot of political commentary in Israel.
What kind of commentary?
Well, some people misunderstood it for a simple partisan manifesto, pro or anti the peaceniks or the extremists, which it was not. More sensible readers realized that, much like Israel itself, this is a novel about great dreams, about great expectations, about bigger-than-life visions, and indeed about the morning after, and the sad realization that every dream come true is bound to be flawed by coming true.
My guest is novelist Amos Oz, and his new novel is titled Black Box. Now, you actually grew up in Jerusalem. You were born there in 1939. Can I ask how your parents came to Jerusalem?
Well, they were both immigrants from Eastern Europe. They came in the early 30s. Very Europeanized people. My father could speak 12 languages, read 17. Deeply devoted to Europe, and yet Europe did not want Jews like my father or my mother at that time. No one in Europe was a European. Everybody was a pan-Slavonic or a pan-Germanic or a communist. So they became Zionists and sadly decided to fund a nation of their own.
Sadly decided?
Sadly decided.
Oh, you mean they would have preferred to stay where they were?
Deep down in their heart of hearts, they belonged in Europe, except they were the only Europeans in Europe in the 30s.
Were they idealists when they came to Israel?
Very much so. They had great expectations, magnanimous dreams. They hoped Israel will become light unto the nations. They wanted the nation to be the most progressive, the most moral, the most powerful, the most sophisticated, the most attractive one on earth.
And how did they pass those dreams on to you when you were growing up?
Well, I was the subject of great expectations. In the first place, those two dark-haired people wanted to beget me fair and blonde, and by some genetic miracle, they even succeeded in that. They wanted me to be a tough, uncomplicated tractor driver, and at the same time they wanted me to retain certain Jewish sensibilities and allegedly certain intellectuality about myself. And I guess in some sort of an uneasy way I've even lived up to that expectation.
You joined a kibbutz when you were 14.
Mm-hmm.
Did your parents encourage you to do this? Did you do this against their wishes?
My mother wasn't alive when I left home and joined the kibbutz.
I see.
My father was immensely unhappy. He was a right-wing, middle-class scholar. He wanted me to be very much the same. He thought I was going to waste my life on driving tractors and nothing else. So leaving home at 14 has been the October Revolution in my personal life. I ended up sitting in a book full of rooms, writing still more books, which is exactly what my father expected for me to do, which may prove that many rebellions and revolutions are, in the end, a full circle.
What was it about the kibbutz that made you want to go there?
I thought that place was real. You know, the middle-class house in which I grew in Jerusalem was full of footnotes, very scholarly. People discussed books. Usually they discussed books dealing with other books. They discussed secondary sources. I thought the kibbutz was full of real people, simple, uncomplicated, uncontaminated by intellect. This was not at all the case. I found the kibbutz loaded with ideologists and dreamers and visionaries of all sorts. And to some extent, I inserted all this into Black Box, into my latest novel. It's all there.
I think it's also in a previous novel called A Perfect Peace.
I guess so. Everything I've written so far has to do with people who want it, whatever it may be. They want it perfect and whole or none at all. They would not settle for less than the absolute.
Israeli novelist Amos Oz is my guest, and his new novel is titled Black Box. I want to ask you about A Perfect Peace for a moment.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's a previous novel of yours, and it's set on a kibbutz, and it's in a way about two different generations. A father who has a kind of democratic ideal for the kibbutz, and a son who is very disillusioned with it and basically wants out. He wants more freedom. He wants more independence. And it's also about newcomers to Israel and to the kibbutz.
Right.
Now, how did that play out in your life once you were on the kibbutz?
Well, I was an outsider myself. I came to the kibbutz, as you have mentioned, at the age of 14 and had an outsider's reception, including its difficulties and harsh niches. But when the book was published, I am glad and proud to say that the reception in the kibbutz was open and passionate. Some people hated its guts, some people liked it. The responses in my own kibbutz ranged all the way from "how dare he" to "at long last someone is telling the truth." Very gutsy.
Do you still live on a kibbutz?
Well, I'm now on a lengthy leave because my younger son developed bad asthma and his doctors decreed fresh desert air for him. But my family and I are hoping to return soon to live on a kibbutz.
Now, you've written in an article that you wrote for the New York Times that you think the kibbutz became less and less inventive drama and more an institutional museum.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to ask you to explain what you meant by that.
Well, I meant that the funders of the kibbutz expected to create a stage on which they live in a state of perpetual ecstasy, revolutionizing the world, revolutionizing their own psyche, revolutionizing life every day. Now, perpetual ecstasy is a self-contradicting concept. You can't expect to have a life of non-stop ecstasy. It's self-defeating. So those people, much like some of my characters, both in A Perfect Peace and in Black Box, are forced to learn to compromise with the prosaic aspects of life. I think that's the great thing about kibbutz, that finally it had discovered a way to live the prosaic everyday life without losing its secret zeal.
But there's a difference between the prosaic everyday life and an institutional museum.
Mm-hmm. Well, the institutional museum aspect of the kibbutz has to do with the fact that, like very many revolutions and world reformings, this one too had changed a lot and had to establish very many rules. Some of it is rigid. Some of it I simply cannot stand because it's too institutionalized.
You had mentioned before that when you went to live on the kibbutz that your father was very, very upset with you. Did you ever reconcile that?
Yes, after I've published a couple of books, which happened shortly before he died, he sort of realized that I was not entirely wasting my life on his terms. So we did compromise in the end. And compromise is the key words. Word. It's not that he gotten to like the way I live or that I have gotten to join his set of values, but we did compromise.
To respect each other and
to
accept
respect
you.
And accept the differences between the two of us.
Mm-hmm. I hate to stretch this into a metaphor, but I guess that's in a way what your stand is on Israel in general. On Israeli politics, more acceptance.
Yes, I'm a great believer in compromising. I think the only alternative to compromising is fight to the death on any front, on any level.
You know, I think a question that has obsessed you personally and in your fiction is why Israel didn't develop into the most egalitarian creative society in the world,
right,
which was what the original vision mm-hmm. was. It's a very big question, and I feel like an idiot asking you to to speculate on answers for that. But what are some of the reasons that come to your mind?
I'll feel like an idiot trying to answer you the question, but I'll try nonetheless. First of all, I don't believe in magnanimous dreams coming true. Every fulfillment of a dream or of an ambition is bound, destined to be partial. Especially because Israel was founded on such a shaky coalition of conflicting and contradicting dreams, master plans, and visions. There was no way they all could come true. The other reason, of course, is that since its creation and even since earlier, Israel has been stuck with a nasty, violent conflict with its Arab neighbors. And I don't think an atmosphere of a constant, violent, hateful conflict is the right atmosphere to create the most egalitarian and just society in the world.
I think in one article you kind of implied that when so many Holocaust survivors came to Israel, their lives had been so tortured that it was hard to maintain the kind of idealistic, open vision because they came feeling quite embattled.
Well, it's not exactly what I said in that article, if I recall correctly. I assume that after the Holocaust, very many Jews, Holocaust survivors and others, ached for normalcy rather than for excellence or uniqueness. Mm-hmm. Normalcy meaning creating a nation state with a military power, a sufficient military power, and playing the cruel game of nations according to its cruel rules, same as everyone else, rather than trying to be the world champions in morality or whatever. That is one of the results of the Holocaust, no doubt.
I want to talk with you more about your writing and about your life in Israel, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is novelist Amos Oz, and his new novel is called The Black Box. We'll talk more after this break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Israeli novelist Amos Oz is my guest. You are one of the founders of the group Peace Now. Yes?
Yes. Yeah. I'm guilty of that, yes.
You've pointed out that Israeli doves aren't pacifists. And in fact, you've fought in two wars yourself, in 67 mm-hmm. and in 73. Was it a hard decision for you to fight, being a dove yourself?
It was a harsh experience, but not a hard decision, and I'd fight again and again if it would be a matter of life and death for the nation. I would not fight, though, for any other cause. I'd not fight for resources, I'd not fight for interests. When it comes to life and death, I have always believed that there is one thing in this world which is more ugly, more sordid than using violence, and this thing is giving in to violence. In this respect, I am a peacenik, not a pacifist. And the Israeli Peace Now movement is clearly not a make-love-not-war movement, not one of those.
How are you changed personally by the Six-Day War?
Now, that's a tough one. It will take a whole novel to describe what the experience of war does to one's system, but I'll tell you a brief little story with your permission.
Please.
In 67, the very first hours of the actual fighting, my men and I had some mortar fire shot at us from a nearby hill by Egyptian soldiers. My immediate first gutsy response was, call the police, those people are crazy. They can see that we are on this hill and they are still shooting at us. I still believe that this immediate instinct, call the police, the civilian response to violence, mm-hmm. was the genuine and healthy one. But a couple of hours later, I felt very differently. I felt it was me or them. And in this respect, having fought a war, you'd never be the same human being. Having shot at people, having been shot at by total strangers, you'd never be the same again.
I guess what I'm wondering, too, I mean, you're someone who's really spoken out for reconciliation with the Arabs. And once you fight in a war against a group of people, you really see them as the enemy. And I should think it would be harder after a war experience to think about reconciliation.
You know, if you mean by reconciliation some Dostoevskian scene of long-lost brothers hugging each other, saying, oh, brother, how could I do a terrible thing to you, such a terrible thing to you? Would you ever forgive me? Then you are right. To me, reconciliation means a political settlement. Mm-hmm. If I had to entitle my vision vis-a-vis the Arabs in general and the Palestinians in particular, I would say, make peace, not love. The name of the game for Israelis and for Palestinians, as I see it, is a fair and decent and painful divorce rather than a honeymoon bed together. I think Israelis and Palestinians should separate land and assets, divide the land between the two nations, and live in peace like two ex-people rather than try to reconcile in the way of living together. The conflict between Israelis and Palestinians is not a family dispute. It's a dispute between two families. That's one thing that is often misunderstood here in America, where the whole issue is taken mistakenly as a civil rights issue. It's not.
I want to get back to that question of why Israel didn't develop into the most egalitarian creative mm-hmm. society in the world. Do you think Israel's democratic vision had to be compromised once it occupied the territories? And once it occupied territories that Arabs lived in, and that the Arabs wouldn't be part of that egalitarian dream?
I think the democratic vision of Israel had to be compromised once Israel was under siege, and the occupation was only an unavoidable continuation of this compromise. You see, no nation on earth had ever been at its best on civil rights while engaged in a deadly war with a deadly enemy. This blessed America not excluded, by the way. I don't think Israel could have achieved a good record on civil rights, on egalitarianism, on brotherhood, while being engaged in a war. If you asked me, I'd say that Israel rates among the decent league of about 25 or 30 nations, where people can still send their governments to hell if they want to. Though Israel presently rates fairly low on this decent list of nations. Nonetheless, it's a fairly remarkable achievement under the circumstances. I don't take it for granted. We may degenerate, we may deteriorate, we may suffer all kinds of nightmarish setbacks. And in a sense, when I wrote Black Box, I was thinking about the fanatic setbacks and the zealots who may change the country into a monster.
Well, right now Israel is faced with the Arab uprisings in the occupied territories. Are those conflicts reinforcing your opinion that Israel should divide and have a Palestinian state and an Israeli state?
Basically, yes. As I said, a fair and a decent divorce between Israelis and Palestinians has been my answer. And I feel even more strongly that this is the answer now with the Palestinian uprising in the occupied territories.
What do you think is left of the utopian vision in Israel? Are there places where you feel it still can be found, where it's still living on?
Oh, there are still enclaves of vision, idealism, dream, and so on and so forth. But if you really wanted me to tell you what is left in one word, I'd say pain and longing.
When you disagree with your government, as you have at times in the past, you've had no problem speaking out?
No, not at all. Not at all.
When it seems to me that over the years you've tried to send a message to American Jews, that message being that supporting Israel is not necessarily supporting the government stand.
This is very well put. I think there is more than one way to be friendly to Israel. There is more than just one way to support Israel and to stand for it. You don't necessarily have to state that right or wrong, it's the government of Israel and we are behind it.
Do you feel that message has been communicated and received in America?
I think it's spreading, though it entails a lot of uneasiness among American friends of Israel, Jews and non-Jews. It evokes a certain uneasiness. There is a kind of tribal instinct to tighten the ranks whenever Israel is in trouble or in hot water.
My guest is Israeli novelist Amos Oz and his new novel is titled Black Box. You know, just as the state of Israel is young, so, of course, is Israeli literature. And I would imagine that there's something very exciting about writing a literature that's so new, if you know what I mean. And, I mean, it's not only the state of Israel, but this body of literature in Hebrew. Because in English, what we're reading is translations, which you've worked on with the translator. But is that an exciting thing, to be part of a new literature?
To call it exciting is an understatement, especially as the literature is not exactly new. It's new in one sense, and it's a renewal of one of the most ancient national literatures in the whole of civilization, on the other hand. We are using Hebrew for a musical instrument, and this musical instrument is both ancient and brand new. To some extent, you could compare contemporary Hebrew to Elizabethan English. It's a volcanic eruption. A writer or a poet of modern Hebrew can still legislate into the language, create new words and new forms. By calling modern Hebrew Elizabethan, I'm not implying, of course, that each and every one of us Israeli novelists is a William Shakespeare. Of those, we don't have more than half a dozen in Tel Aviv presently. But the fascination of creating in a melting lava is all there. And indeed, there is a tremendously exciting literary scene in Israel right now.
One thing that I can imagine would be frustrating is that a lot of Jews around the world like to read Israeli novelists, and writing in Hebrew. Most Jews outside of Israel don't speak Hebrew, so they wouldn't be reading the novel in the language it was written in. Is that frustrating for you?
No, it should be frustrating for them.
Well put, right.
I'm just enjoying the fact that I'm having Hebrew for a wonderful musical instrument. You know, I may not be much of a chauvinist for the nation as such or for the territory, but I am terribly adamant and keen on the language. I would not part from it, even if I had 20 readers all over the world in the original. I'd still write in it.
While you're in America, are you, in addition to talking about your new book, trying to speak with American Jewish groups or political groups?
Yes, I had a couple of encounters with Jewish audiences, political audiences, trying to convey the complexity of the situation in the Middle East and prevent people from thinking in simplistic terms of good guys and bad guys. This message I've been trying to convey to my audiences here in this country.
I want to ask you about something you said earlier. You described earlier about how your father was basically very right-wing and how his views were very different from yours. So you grew up in a family with a father who you really disagreed with, but you learned to reconcile.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that growing up in a family like that and having views as different as your father has helped you understand what reconciliation is about, and helped you respect people who you feel are very different from you?
Yes, indeed. Moreover, it taught me even how to almost love even that which I hate or cannot stand. And I almost like even that which I cannot stand in Israel. I always remind myself that with the slightest twist of my own biography, of my own birth circumstances, I could be one of those quote-unquote terrible characters. I think it was D.H. Lawrence who once said, I'm obviously paraphrasing, that to write a novel, you must be able to maintain half a dozen different conflicting and contradicting views about the same question simultaneously and with an equal degree of conviction. And in writing novels, I've been doing just that.
To really try to understand all sides.
More than understand, emphasize.
Mm-hmm.
Step right into their shoes and penetrate right under their skins, or else I would not write a novel. Normally, when I'm in a total agreement with myself on whatever question, I don't write a story or a novel. I write an angry article telling my government what it should do, not that anyone listens. It's normally when I'm in a slight disagreement with myself, hearing in me more than just one voice over a certain issue, that sometimes these conflicting voices are the embryos of a story or a novel.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your novels and about your life. Thank you.
Thank you.
My guest has been Israeli novelist Amos Oz, and his novels include A Perfect Peace and his new book, Black Box. Black Box has just been published by Harcourt Brace Jovanovich. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with film and theater director Ilya Kazan. He directed Marlon Brando in On the Waterfront and James Dean in East of Eden. He also co-founded the Actors Studio with Lee Strasberg. I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. When Rick Springfield had his hit song, Jesse's Girl, he was the subject of articles in every teen magazine in America. Coming up, Rick Springfield talks about how he was packaged into a heartthrob and how he's trying to lose that image with his new album. Also, Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of Mozart Serenades performed by the Prague Philharmonic Orchestra under the direction of Sir Charles Mackerras. And some people use travel as a way to banish bad memories. Others use alcohol. Poet Mark Halliday chases bad memories away with a poem that he reads for us. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Lori Waffen-Schmidt. At least 9 people were killed today in an explosion at a rocket fuel plant in Nevada. As many as 200 people are reported injured. The blast at the Pacific Engineering and Production Company near Las Vegas was felt at least 17 miles away. Eyewitnesses say an orange-gray cloud was visible above the entire Las Vegas Valley. Plant officials say the explosion was caused by a malfunction in a piece of machinery. Pacific Engineering makes rocket fuel for the space shuttle program. Morton Thiokol officials say the accident shouldn't affect the shuttle program. A week after an Aloha Airlines jet ripped open at 24,000 feet, the Federal Aviation Administration today announced it is expanding its required inspections of aging Boeing 737s. FAA Administrator Alan McCarter says an initial inspection of the Aloha jet raised concerns about a bonding process used in older 737s. Under the new order, 737s that have flown more than 30,000 flights will be visually inspected. If cracks are found, a more sophisticated electronic inspection will be performed. 3 French hostages held by a pro-Iranian group in Lebanon were released today in Beirut, where they were turned over to Syrian officials. In Paris, Lynn Terry has more.
The French Interior Minister said the 3 hostages were with his special envoy. According to French state radio, the 3 men boarded a private plane for Paris. They reportedly looked exhausted when they were released. Diplomats Marcel Carton and Marcel Fontaine and journalist Jean-Paul Kaufman have been held since 1985 by the Islamic Jihad, a group of pro-Iranian Muslim extremists who are also holding 2 Americans captive. The 3 men were the last French hostages in Lebanon. Their release is expected to help the presidential bid of Prime Minister Jacques Chirac in the final ballot on Sunday. He's been lagging behind in the polls, and according to news reports, Chirac's government has been negotiating with Iran for months in hopes of obtaining their release before the elections. Tonight, the Interior Minister said the government just did what was necessary, but he refused to give more details. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
A report released today by a Senate congressional subcommittee charges that Attorney General Edwin Meese violated a White House policy in connection with the bankrupt WedTech Corporation. NPR's Phyllis Crockett has details.
The report says that WedTech would not have received millions of dollars in Army contracts were it not for the intervention of the White House. According to the report, Meese, who was the president's counselor at the time, violated White House policy by intervening on behalf of WedTech. Meese got involved with WedTech through his good personal friend E. Robert Wallach, who was a consultant to the firm. Meese has acknowledged that he asked his staff to look into the WedTech matter after receiving memos from Wallach. Today, Committee Chairman Senator Carl Levin said in a statement, quote, "In looking under the WedTech rock, the subcommittee has uncovered a picture of greed, influence peddling, and corruption," unquote. The committee did not accuse Meese of those things, nor did it say he violated any laws. Meese's attorney, James Rocap, says Meese has done absolutely nothing improper. I'm Phyllis Crockett in Washington.
A major information effort aimed at explaining AIDS prevention was kicked off by the government today. The Department of Health and Human Services is mailing an explicit 8-page booklet on AIDS to every American household. Surgeon General C. Everett Koop calls the $17 million mailing project the closest the government can come to making something required reading by all Americans. He hopes families will read and discuss it.
Although I think we have made substantial progress through our educational campaign on AIDS, studies tell us that there are still millions of Americans who believe you can get AIDS from mosquitoes, blood donations for transfusion, toilet seats, and sitting next to a child in school.
The booklet should start appearing in mailboxes May 26th. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Classical music critic Lord Schwartz has a review of a new recording of Mozart serenades with Sir Charles Mackerras conducting the Prague Chamber Orchestra. Mackerras is probably best known for his highly acclaimed recordings of music by the Czech composer Janáček. And Lloyd says the conductor has captured the complexity and texture of Mozart with equal sensitivity.
This week's recording is a new album of music written in Salzburg, recorded in Prague by a record company from Cleveland, and led by a conductor who was born in Schenectady, New York, to Australian parents, and who was knighted for his performances in England. Sir Charles Mackerras, it turns out, was a student of the greatest 20th century Czech conductor, Václav Talich, which also helps explain why Mackerras is so good at everything else, including the two Mozart serenades on this album. Serenades are 18th-century formalizations of music that a young nobleman might play at night under his lady's balcony. There are often passages in which strings are strummed or plucked to suggest a guitar or mandolin. The two serenades on this recording were written by Mozart in 1776, when he was 20. The Haffner Serenade was commissioned by a Mozart family friend, Sigmund Haffner, the son of the former mayor of Salzburg. The music was for his sister's June wedding. 6 years later, Mozart wrote his more famous Haffner Symphony to honor this same friend. The Serenade is a complex work, part symphony, part violin concerto, and part sinfonia concertante with many instrumental solos. And it's long, 8 movements. It was probably meant to be played outdoors, beginning around 9 p.m., and intended to fill the entire evening. Suiting the happy occasion, the Haffner Serenade is a brilliant, cheerful work, including 3 minuets and 3 movements with big violin solos. One of the minuets, however, is in the disturbing key of G minor, the key of some of Mozart's most profoundly tragic music. It's not really tragic here, but nevertheless a cloud of pain passes over the moonlit festivities. But perhaps the heart of the serenade is the 6th movement Andante, with its tuneful variations that are somehow not only elegant but moving, like a love song, a serenade, sung in one of Mozart's operas. Thank you. Mozart later converted this serenade into a symphony by adding a timpani and eliminating the three movements with violin solos. The evening music continues on this album with the charming Serenata Notturna, a much shorter work in only three movements, evidently meant to start later in the evening. It begins with a rousing march, though it was probably intended for indoors, since this work was written in the month of January. Its most interesting feature is the contrast between a string quartet, with double bass instead of cello, and the string orchestra with timpani. The middle movement minuet is especially appealing. Performances are excellent, buoyant, crisp, full of rhythmic snap, crackle, and pop. Though Mackerras uses modern instruments, he's clearly not oblivious to the discoveries of the early instrument specialists. Yet there is more nuance, a greater flexibility of phrasing and variety of feeling here than any conductorless early instrument style performance could probably ever have.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed a new recording of Mozart's Serenades with Sir Charles Mackerras and the Prague Chamber Orchestra on the Telarc label. This is Fresh Air. Rick Springfield is one of the few performers to claim simultaneous careers as a teen rock star and soap opera star. While his stint on General Hospital only lasted a year and a half, his music career continued past his first hit, Jessie's Girl. But after his last album, Dow, he took a break from recording. Now he's back with his sixth album called Rock of Life. From the new album, here's Honeymoon in Beirut. I know this is your first album in about 3 years, so let me ask you why you took that long break from recording.
It was a necessary thing for my life. I just had to take some time. I was pretty burned out from touring and everything, and I just had to take some time off and just spend it with myself. I also had a son at that point, too, which was really pivotal in me taking the time off.
I'm interested in hearing more about your life. Now, I knew you grew up in Australia, and I think so many American musicians were influenced by the Beatles. Was there a kind of British invasion of Australia when you were growing up?
Oh, yeah, completely. It was really worldwide. Although I loved the Beatles, bands like the Yardbirds and the Animals, I also, they were the songs that I used to do in bands. There was more, you know, I got the first band I was in or the guys were a lot older than me. I was about 16, and they were like 25 and 26. And so they turned me on to a lot of blues stuff. At the time, the Stones were doing a lot of blues stuff, and it was when it was very hip to do the most obscure blues music you could discover. So I got a kind of an education at that point.
Now, I know you took a band that you were playing into Vietnam to play for the troops there. What year was this?
68.
Why did you want to do that? Especially being Australian, you know, it's especially interesting to me.
Well, I was 17 at that point, and I hadn't really read a newspaper. It was music, you know, it was day and night, so I wasn't really aware of what was going on. I was just aware that there was a war, and basically this guy came to me with the offer to go to Vietnam, and it was, for me, it was money and travel, you know, and I didn't really think of the war until I got there. And we were pretty much in the thick of it as far as a non-fighting unit can get. We were certainly we were under fire just about at least a couple of times a week.
Must have been quite an awakening.
Yeah, it was. It was really, I was, you know, the diary that I kept at the time was just filled with fear of dying the whole time.
After Vietnam, you returned to Australia. And I think you had a number one single there, yes?
Yeah, I joined a band, actually, that became real successful. I had, like, a couple of top 10 singles called Zoot.
Uh-huh. And you were the singer in the band?
No, actually, I was just a guitar player, but I left and had a solo single, and that's probably the one you're talking about.
So it was after that single that you came to America?
Yeah.
Now, what year is it?
1971.
Were you packaged when you came to America?
Yeah, I didn't realize at the time. I mean, you know, obviously I was... I was young and, you know, young and cute and foreign, and so they stuck me in teen magazines, and I had never really seen a teen magazine until that point, so I just thought it was publicity.
What were some of the surprises of actually being interviewed for teen magazines?
I just couldn't quite understand the banality of some of the questions. I said, why would you want to ask me that? You know, it took a while for me really to catch on once I'd seen some of the magazines and saw, you know, basically what they were trying to do.
So did it catch on right away? You were supposed to become, I guess, a teen rock star or a teen idol. Did the magic work right away?
No, because I wasn't writing the music that they... I mean, I was writing, you know, my first album was a string-oriented ballad kind of album with songs about divorce and suicide and you know, and the kids would buy the magazine and then pick up the album and go, wait a minute, this can't be the same person.
So which was the record that first actually caught on?
Jesse's Girl would have been the first one that really had any success.
The lyrics of that are pretty interesting. It's about fantasizing making love to your best friend's girlfriend. Did that actually happen? Is that something that you...
Often.
Yeah. Does your friend know that it's him that the song's based on?
No, I don't see the guy anymore. I still have friends that are sure it was them, but...
Yeah, I could see how that would make things a little uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Jesse is a friend. Yeah, I know he's been a good friend of mine. Lately something's changed, it ain't hard to define. Jesse's got himself a girl and I wanna make her mine. And she's watching him with those eyes, and she's loving him with that body, I just know it. And he's holding her in his arms late at night. You know I wish that I had Jesse's girl. I wish that I had Jesse's girl. Where can I find her? Play along with the charade.
Now, Jesse's Girl coincided with your run on General Hospital, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you played Dr. Noah Drake. I'll confess I never saw General Hospital.
I confess I never did either.
I was working while it was on. What kind of role was it?
Well, a suave doctor, you know, he spent more time in the sack than in the operating room was basically the attitude.
How come you auditioned for it?
I was broke, you know, and I hadn't worked. I was doing bit parts on TV since 1976, and it was, you know, paying the light bill, but it wasn't really getting anywhere. And at that point that I auditioned for that, and also got the contract with the recording deal with RCA, I hadn't worked in like 9 months.
Had you watched soap operas before? Did you understand their appeal?
No, I still don't.
I think a lot of people, when the album with Jesse's Girl came out, thought that you were a soap opera star trying to break into music, when actually you'd been playing music all along and had just started breaking into acting. Did that bother you when people had that wrong impression?
Oh, just a little. Yeah, it did. You know, I'm still basically, that's still, it's still there for a lot of people, you know. I mean, I don't think a lot of people realize. But, you know, I mean, it worked out the way it worked out. I'm sure not mad about the way it worked out.
Now, you've just come back to music after a 3-year absence. When a lot of your fans are teenagers, as I think a lot of your fans are, 3 years is a really long period of time. It's a difference between 15 and 18, or 18 and 21, 17 and 20. And I think for a lot of younger people, when they get 3 years older, they want to be like more mature than they were 3 years ago, and they'll sometimes deny the taste that they had 3 years ago and think that they've outgrown music that they used to like. Do you think that that's happened to some of your listeners?
I don't know. I really don't know what the audiences will certainly know when we go out on tour this summer. But for me, I mean, my music's changed a lot. I'm lyrically, it's about a lot different things than I was writing about in 1980. And I can't guide people to the music or say, you know, who's going to like the music. It's a totally open thing.
Rick Springfield spoke with us from the NPR Bureau in Los Angeles. His new album is called Rock of Life. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up with full coverage of today's news. Let's check in with co-host Renee Montaigne and see what they have planned. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What story are you following?
Well, Terry, this is the last day for illegal aliens to apply to become legal. And so we'll have a report on the last-minute crush that is, even as we speak, occurring at a really busy amnesty center in Texas. Also, a portent of capitalistic things to come. It was announced today that Pepsi commercials will run on television in the Soviet Union during the summit.
Is Michael Jackson in them?
Yes. The famous Michael Jackson commercial is one of them. And also, the Pepsi generation of Russians will have a spot showing a cosmonaut and an astronaut each trying to grab a Pepsi floating in space.
Okay, thanks, Renee. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Poet Mark Halliday joins us to share a poem that was his solution for sorting through some bad memories. Halliday's 1987 collection of poems, Little Star, was published by William Morrow as part of the prestigious National Poetry Series. The poem we're going to hear is a new one.
The poem I want to read is called Memory Sampler. I've always been an autobiographical kind of poet, the kind of poet who really has to sort through and deal with memories of my own personal past. Of course, everybody has a set of troubling memories that they need to deal with in some way. For me, it's always seemed necessary to deal with them in language. So each time I find myself focusing on a troubling or confusing moment in my past, I have the desire to write a poem about it. But I've also felt sometimes that there were just too many moments like this crowding my memory, waiting for a poem that would deal with them. So I wrote this poem, Memory Sampler, out of a desire, an impulse to kind of dispose of a whole bunch of memories all at once and get rid of them so I could kind of move on from there. So the poem, the catalog of memories that the poem produces, reflects that desire to get past a lot of problems all at once. Memory Sampler. in the waiting room of a health clinic in Providence, Rhode Island, in an alley next to a furniture store in Copenhagen, on a hill of sheer silence overlooking a factory yard in Göteborg, Sweden, on a bench by a park fountain in Raleigh, North Carolina, after insulting a friend, on a stool in the car Rexall in Raleigh, North Carolina, with no idea of myself, yelling, "Nowhere to go," under a pink night sky in Providence, Rhode Island, in the back of an airless appliance store in Providence, Rhode Island, in the cab of a rented truck on a moonlit street in Cranston, Rhode Island, suddenly alone in the elevator of an all-brown apartment building in Brooklyn, on the wrong bus in the dark, borderless maze of Queens, in the boys' room of Pine Street Elementary School in Gunnison, Colorado, in a bleak bed with an ex-lover in Providence, Rhode Island, in the odorous green bathroom of a Chinese restaurant in Providence, Rhode Island, in an elevator rocketing downward to blank, blank freedom in the Time Life building in Manhattan, at a corner table among chucklers chuckling in the Players Tavern in Westport, Connecticut, sick with ambition on a tennis court in Westport, Connecticut, incredibly alone on a highway in the great quiet night outside Aix-en-Provence, in Okemo Ski Lodge in Ludlow, Vermont, without the boomy, bloody gusto of skiers, in a pizza parlor with the wrong girl, or wrong self, near Vassar College in Poughkeepsie, New York, lying with poison ivy on a cot on the porch of a cottage near Frankfort, Michigan, asking for a payphone in a gas station in Rochester, New York, arriving 20 minutes late for an unlikely rendezvous at the British Museum in London, and staring, desperately uninterested, at Egyptian relics, and, elsewhere, like you, I have felt I was without sufficient help. And yet, here we are, reading together, as if rescued, lucky.
Mark Halliday teaches at the University of Pennsylvania. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow, some advice on how not to invest your nest egg. John Rothschild sank $16,500 in the stock market and 1 year later had $800 left. His new book satirizes investment guides on how to make a million. Also, our rock critic Ken Tucker will review the debut album of singer-songwriter Tracy Chapman. And Stephen Schiff will review Babette's Feast, this year's Oscar winner for Best Foreign Film. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Fred Landrell. Production assistance from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Ron Barron. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.